Beware the fog of war. Every side in a war creates narratives. They construct storylines that fit their agenda. U.S. policy isn't about helping Ukraine. It's about U.S. imperial strategic aim. And right now, what's shaping up appears to be a campaign to bleed Russia in a prolonged war that will kill thousands, if not tens of thousands, more Ukrainians.
Welcome to episode 104 of the Reviews Fascism podcast, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Reviews Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and a host of the show. Reviews Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. Before we get to today's show, I want to give a shout out to our monthly sustainers. We couldn't do the show without you. Sign up to become a monthly sustainer of Reviews Fascism at ReviewsFascism.org. Hit the donate button. Thanks to everyone who's rated, reviewed, subscribed, and follows to help us reach more listeners. If you haven't yet, go do it. Of course, I've listened to today's episode. Shout out to BS Pill One, who reviewed us on Apple Podcasts and wrote, becoming one of my go-to podcasts. Pay attention, people. Thanks, BS Pill One. With all the big monetized shows that have staff and publicists, we appreciate that you value what we have to say. We read all your reviews, emails, notes, messages. After listening to this episode, share your thoughts with us. Leave us a voicemail. Click the button at anchor.fm/refuse-fascism, and you might even hear yourself on a future episode. In today's show, we're sharing an excerpt of a webinar presentation given by Paul Schreed for the Refuse Fascism Chicago chapter on March 14th, titled False Narratives on the War in Ukraine. Paul is a historian, author, and journalist. He's a member of the National Editorial Board of ReviewsFascism.org and a frequent guest on this show. His latest book is This Happened Here, Americaners, Neoliberals, and the Trumping of America. We want to give a big shout out to the Louisiana students who held a walkout against anti-LGBTQ bills. Cheers to the hundreds of high school students at Ben Franklin High School who held a walkout to protest Louisiana House Bill 570, which would prohibit transition-related healthcare for transgender children, and HB 837, which would prohibit discussion of LGBTQ topics in Louisiana classrooms. We'll have more on these protests hopefully soon. If you know somebody who participated, please DM us on social media or email me. Let's talk about some developments from the past week as it relates to the rising fascist threat and the importance and impact of standing up against it. And let's face it, this week was a week in honestly a surprise to nobody paying attention in a series of messages, 29 in all, to then Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. In the weeks after Election Day, Virginia Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, called Biden's victory, quote unquote, the greatest heist of our history, and told him that President Donald Trump shouldn't concede. As Wajahat Ali tweeted this week, quote, for those who mocked us when we used the F word fascism, you have a compromised Supreme Court justice whose wife actively supported and funded a coup and violent insurrection to overturn a free and fair election, end quote. Many have been hand-wringing, where's Merrick Garland, and calling for Justice Clarence Thomas to be impeached. Some commentators have noted the Dems aren't built for this fight, but have come to the very wrong conclusion that the Dems are all we have. The Democrats are not and will not fight this the way it must be fought. But who says that's all we have? All of us who refuse fascism need to stop banking on a savior or wishing it away and create a groundswell from below so determined that they must respond. In related news, Representative Mo Brooks, once one of Trump's most loyal supporters, who was among the first to pledge to work to use the certification of the election on January 6th to overturn the results. A speaker during the Stop the Steal rally at the White House ellipse that preceded the coup attempt, where donning a Kevlar vest, he told the crowd to, quote unquote, start taking down names and kicking ass, and then directed them to, quote, carry that message to Capitol Hill, end quote, has since lost Trump's endorsement for not continuing to facilitate the overturn of the election. Mo Brooks told WIAT, quote, the president has asked me to rescind the election of 2020. He always brings up, we've got to rescind the election. We've got to take Joe Biden down and put me in now, end quote. When asked if Trump still says that to him, Brooks said, yes. Trump believes he should be president, is actively pressuring members of Congress now to overthrow the U.S. government. A defeated, twice impeached president is actively seeking a coup after attempting one in plain view with the help of at least one sitting congressman, and almost certainly more. And this isn't a major story. This should be front page news. Okay, going on. The confirmation hearings for Ketanji Brown Jackson this week were turned into a repulsive mix of tantrum, circus, reality TV show, and firing line run through with the most vengeful white supremacy and misogyny. The questions asked hit every major fascist agenda item, from defining gender to critical race theory, from QAnon-style insinuations about child pornography to affirmative action to a personal faith in God. They claimed the nominee was too hard on anti-abortion terrorists and tellingly claimed that therefore she must be biased against anyone in the so-called pro-life movement. But the questions weren't really the point. Most likely, Judge Jackson will be confirmed and placed in a position on the toothless 3-6 liberal minority of the fascist-dominated Supreme Court. These hearings are a venue for the fascist GOP to consolidate, broadcast, and make a spectacle of their increasingly violent fascist program. Lindsey Graham stormed off. Ted Cruz would have been kicked out of a third grade classroom, let alone any other place of employment, for his extreme obstruction, blatantly disregarding and disrespecting the rules in order to insinuate a Democratic Party cover-up of pedophilia, arguably accusing them of serious crimes. But instead, his actions were normalized. This was not just theater, but reinforcement that the rabid bullheadedness of the Republifascists is not just for their thugs storming Capitol. The level of contempt seething through every word from the GOP interrogators for the audacity of a Black woman to sit before them was palpable. In this process, Republican senators have made clear that gay marriage, the legality of gay sex, interracial marriage, the right to birth control, foundational right to privacy, and everything it entails, none of it is settled law. They are moving to enshrine fetal personhood, not just go after abortion rights. What was the stuff of Fox News host rants are now in the halls of power. And as you would expect, what's on Fox News in the right-wing media machine is going even further. But we also saw the other side of this. Judge Jackson was lauded for enduring with poise this abuse from these foaming mouth fascists. Democrats chaired this hearing and allowed, with maybe one or two exceptions, all of this abuse. Not tough questions, but rule-breaking abuse to go on. They avoided actual urgent issues facing the Supreme Court and let stand the blatant lies of the fascists in the room. Turning to abortion rights, which are a battering ram and linchpin of this fascist movement, this week has underscored that this is a do or literally die moment. As reported by the Washington Post, quote, 6 months after the Texas ban took effect, as the Supreme Court considers a case that could overturn or significantly weaken Roe, anti-abortion legislators across the country are newly energized, passing bills that could reshape the abortion landscape in the United States by the end of summer, end quote. Energized. What are they energized for? Let's take a look. Idaho became the first to sign into law a copycat law of Texas's 6-week abortion ban enforced by bounty hunting vigilantes and went even further, incentivizing rapists and their families to act as vigilantes to sue anyone who assists a woman in getting an abortion. This is set to go into effect mid-April. The House in Oklahoma, where many people travel from Texas for abortions if they can scrape together the resources, approved a near total ban on abortion enforced through the same mechanisms as the Texas ban. Arizona, following Florida, following Mississippi, has approved a 15-week abortion ban, awaiting the signature of Governor Doug Ducey, who has signed every anti-abortion measure that has reached his desk. 15-week abortion bans have passed at least one chamber in West Virginia and Kentucky. And in South Dakota and Wyoming, near total bans on abortion pills have at least passed one chamber. More than a dozen states have proposed their own version of the Texas abortion ban, and all utilize the Texas law's enforcement mechanism. Let's be clear, these lunatics do not give a fuck about what's constitutional. These same people did a coup. They're condemning women to enslavement and death and punishing doctors and anyone who has the audacity to see them as full human beings. This fascist, woman-hating thuggery will get worse unless we rise up. It's why we need to be in the streets refusing to go along with their fascist future. Being in the streets in such a way that we force every institution to respond to our demand, shaking all of society awake. Those of us who know the emergency that we face, that you listening, you get it, need to be part of bringing other people out. Refuse Fascism is calling on everyone who refuses to roll over in the face of this fascist assault on abortion rights to sound the alarm and to declare that now is the time to fight. We're getting into the streets with RiseUpForAbortionRights.org. Sign and share the Rise Up for Abortion Rights statement. Wear green for abortion on April 8th. Display it everywhere and protest April 9th. Visit riseupforthenumberabortionrights.org. Now to today's main topic. We're talking about Ukraine today, and this is a contentious topic, not just in society at large, but within the movement Stop American Fascism. Many of those who are in the anti-Trump movement that are part of intelligentsia or public commentators are declaring that this is a battle between authoritarianism and democracy and lining people up behind a war that could go nuclear and do tremendous harm if it is not stopped. The views here are not consensus or representative of the entire movement or organization of Refuse Fascism. Paul's words are Paul's. My words are mine. And we'd love to hear how you're seeing this as well. Now, with that disclaimer, I want to say two things before we get right into what Paul has to say. We're not going to talk about Ukraine as an isolated incident, something that just happened one day, this war. It's not a mythic battle of good versus evil, and it's not, as many U.S. politicians and pundits, including those in the anti-Trump left, would have you believe, a battle over autocracy versus democracy. Paul breaks this down some, but on a larger level, I just want to encourage people to recognize that there is a system that is setting the turn, a system that Russia, Ukraine, the U.S., and everyone else involved is a mesh. The system of capitalism and imperialism. It's not just human nature or personalities or whatever, but it's the dynamics of that system that is the foundation on which these nations are making decisions and taking actions, escalating or resolving this. And that system is something that can be understood. I'm proud to be building this movement with people from diverse perspectives, united in their determination to refuse fascism in this country. And I appreciate as well the opportunity to share my own perspectives. To that end, I want to share a quote from revolutionary Baba Vagian that I think provides important clarity. Quote, besides the fact that the U.S. is today and historically been aligned with many, quote unquote, authoritarian governments throughout the world, and in fact has forcibly installed such governments in many countries, the even more fundamental fact is that the essence of the conflict between the U.S. and countries like Russia and China is not one between, quote unquote, democracy and, quote unquote, authoritarianism, but is a matter of rivalry among imperialist powers, all of which are monstrous oppressors of the masses of people and none of which represents or act in the interests of humanity. What is called for and urgently now is to oppose all imperialist marauders and mass murderers and all systems and relations of oppression and exploitation, while giving particular emphasis to opposing, quote unquote, our own imperialist oppressors who commit their monstrous crimes in our name, and to seek to rally us to support them on the basis of a grotesque American chauvinism, which we must firmly reject and fiercely struggle against, end quote. I encourage people to check out revcom.us for more. Now, here's Paul.
Beware the fog of war. When I say fog of war, I mean a couple of things. In the most obvious and commonplace sense in which the phrase fog of war is understood is that every side in a war creates narrative to support their side. They want to win people over to their side so they construct storylines that fit their agenda. There's another meaning, I guess, of fog of war that means that things start moving very quickly and become very anarchic and unpredictable, and there's sort of chaos and it's hard to keep track of them. That's certainly true, too. I just realized that that's another meaning. And then I think there's a third meaning of the fog of war, which is that during war, during international conflicts, and particularly during wars, there's a kind of cover that comes over societies where people get so distracted by what's happening outside their borders or maybe along their borders, sometimes inside their borders, that we lose sight of the wars that are being taken place against the people in the countries. The wars at home, the war on people of color, the war on immigrants, the war on gay and transgender people, the war on women, the war on civil and voting rights, the war on truth, the war on history, the war on the teaching of accurate history in this country, last but not least, the war on livable ecology. A lot of these things tend to go under the radar screen. Police shootings tend to go under the radar screen. Attacks on civil rights tend to go under the radar screen as everybody becomes focused on the great military conflict. But let me get back to that first one, though, to cut through the BS on all the propaganda and all the false narratives that get out there. Let's try and cut through the fog of the Ukraine crisis, the Ukraine war. I don't have time here to take down in detail all the Russian lies, many of which have been just almost slavishly taken up by and repeated by what I call the Pavlovian enemy of my enemy is my friend, fake left. Putin had no alternative but to invade. False. Images of Russia bombing civilian targets are fake news. Not true. False. Ukraine isn't a country. Wrong. Ukraine is a Nazi state, and Russia's invasion is a repeat of the great patriotic Soviet war against fascism during World War II. False. Ukraine is committing genocide against Russian speakers. All the imperialism in this conflict is on NATO's side. which is, incidentally, America's side, because NATO is the United States by and large.
Russia is an imperialist. It's just practicing national self-defense.
All of this is complete BS. I think the more important lies for us, given where we are in the belly of the beast of the greatest empire the world has ever seen, are the most significant ones that we have the greatest moral duty to question. These are the false narratives that it is our greatest responsibility to critique, the ones on the Western / US / NATO site. Let us not call it falsely now. False Western narrative. NATO is just a defensive European alliance. Bullshit. NATO is an extension, an arm of US power. It is the American eagle to the Russian bear in Europe. NATO has fought offensive wars beyond Europe in Afghanistan and Libya, and it trains and it coordinates for actions far beyond Europe and indeed around the world. Russia's invasion was completely unprovoked by the US, NATO, and the West. I've heard this over and over and over again. This is almost like a religious pronunciation to be doctrinally replicated by anchors at CNN, anchors at MSNBC, and anchors at Fox News, which are all sort of surprisingly on board in on the Ukraine crisis, except with the kind of weird aspect that Fox has these weird things it does where it's everything's about how we got to dig up more fossil fuels. They're spinning everything around fossil fuels. But they all say this. It's completely unprovoked. This is complete nonsense. And I want to return to this in a few minutes in some detail because it's very important to break it down. The other ones that I'm going to mention here now can be just dealt with right away. And then I want to return to that. Putin wants to restore the Soviet Union. Putin wants to restore the USSR. That's not true. Listen to a speech that he gave on the eve of the invasion. It was anti-Soviet. It was anti-Lenin. It was much more in line with Catherine the Great. It was part of an older pre-Soviet Russian imperial project. Putin is only admired by idiots on the left. Anybody that's on the left that admires Putin is out of their mind, in my opinion. I'm sorry. He's a hero for some very good reasons, which maybe we can get into in the Q&A, for the fascist right, for the white nationalist right, for the patriarchal strongman wannabe right of the United States and also of Western Europe. And he's an anti-Soviet. He's an anti-communist. There's a reason he's a global hero for fascists all over the world, but not for people on the left, not for socialists. False Western narrative is this whole democracy versus autocracy storyline that is repeated again and again and again and again by the talking heads in the political class and the media class. Zelensky and Ukraine are supposedly great champions of democracy. No, they're agents, they're embodiments of bourgeois democracy. I always kind of hesitate to use the phrase because it's sort of oxymoronic. Bourgeois democracy is a form of, in a cloak war, capitalist class rule, which is not democracy. We have bourgeois democracy here in the U.S., where majority and generally progressive public opinion is consistently canceled by concentrated wealth and power on issue after issue after issue. And of course, we don't just have any kind of normal bourgeois democracy. We have a very strange and curious form of bourgeois democracy wedded to a slave owner's charter that was written and passed in the time of Louis XVI in the late 18th century. False Western narrative, sanctions on ordinary people lead them to rise up in rebellion against their dictator. And by the way, if you don't think Putin's a dictator, just look at how he's responded to the aftermath of his invasion, all the people he's locking up. So he is a dictator. You got a problem with that on the left. You got a problem. He's a dictator. But sanctions do not have a very good historical record when it comes to turning people against regimes. That is not how it worked in Iraq at all. In fact, if anything, they give dictators a kind of distractive, deflective ability to blame external forces for the misery people are experiencing on them. I know Noam Chomsky argued repeatedly that the sanctions in Iraq deepened the power of Saddam Hussein there. If people thought economic sanctions on Iran were going to lead the people to overthrow the mullahs and the theocratic powers there, that has not been borne out. So it works the other way. Granted, we don't know, because these are absolutely remarkable sanctions. It's very important to keep in mind that it's almost as if people think like sanctions are this benign, peaceful, nonviolent response to imperial aggression. People die from sanctions, okay? They can't get medicine. They're knocked out of employment. They can't buy basic food necessities anymore. Tens of thousands have died from sanctions in Iraq, in Iran, and elsewhere. It involves huge human suffering for ordinary, common, working class, lower class, middle class people who have not been consulted on things like Saddam's decision to invade Kuwait or like Vladimir Putin's decision to invade Ukraine.
False Western narrative. Putin wants to march into NATO territory, starting with Poland. He has no interest in negotiations. There's no off-ramps for Putin. It's not just about Ukraine. It's a war on all of Europe and indeed all of civilization. So we must pull out all the stops, fight Putin to the last drop of blood, come hell or high water. I can't tell you how many people I've seen say this or words to this effect on the cable news channels. And of course, with this kind of warmongering sentiment being deeply reinforced by not made up, but very real and therefore all the more potent images of devastating criminal assaults on real people in Ukraine. But this notion that Putin wants to just go all the way, that he's not going to stop, he's going to go into NATO territory, is highly dubious. It's a very dubious narrative. Putin has had a very difficult time subduing just Ukraine. He appears to have underestimated the task. Contrary to Donald Trump's early description as of Putin as a genius who really made a really smart move, he's having all kinds of resource issues. There appear to have been significant strategic mistakes leading to the firing of some of his generals. He's having huge morale issues among his troops and in his own populace, which is facing an imploding economy. NATO is consolidating like no time in recent memory in the wake of the Ukraine invasion. I don't think Putin wanted that. Finland and Sweden are talking about joining NATO. Historically, epically, monumentally neutral, Switzerland signed on with the sanctions. Images of civilian destruction are making Putin, in part of the world, certainly in the West, into more of a pariah than he'd ever been before. He's being portrayed as something like an evil, dastardly, sinister criminal in a James Bond movie. It's kind of a disaster for him in some ways, arguably. But in any event, the idea that he has the ability or the desire to push beyond Ukraine, to me, seems far-fetched. I think he knows it would mean mushroom clouds over Moscow. Second problem here is that Russia has, in fact, sent out feelers and terms for the cessation of hostilities. There are terms for the cessation of hostilities. You know, how serious they really are, well, I guess we'll find out. Basically, neutrality for Ukraine, which is an understandable thing for them to want. I'll get into that in a second. Plus the recognition of the fait accompli of Russia's annexation of Crimea, and plus independence for two breakaway Russian-speaking provinces in the eastern part of Ukraine. These things are negotiable. It's complex. But it's increasingly likely that Putin needs and wants some kind of off-ramp to end this thing. False narrative, a no-fly zone and jet planes would save lives. At the risk of being simplistic, here's the problem with that. There's 40 million people or so left in Ukraine right now, and there's 8 billion people still stuck on Earth who haven't found another planet to relocate to in case of World War III. And at the risk of sounding crassly humanitarian, I'm not ready to sacrifice 8 billion people and the future of the species for 40 million people. And of course, if we did graduate to World War III, as we could, the Ukrainian 40 million would be lost as well, obviously. They'd be the first among the first incinerated in a war. Run away from anybody like Zelensky who tells you Putin is just, quote unquote, bluffing about nuclear war. Do you really want to test that hypothesis? Do we want to run that experiment? We've been lucky. Lucky as hell to have avoided World War III as long as we have with all the nuclear weapons in the world. That's not a game to be played. Oh, he's bluffing. Let's give this maniac, and I think he might be a bit of a maniac, some kind of off-ramp before this nightmare goes nuclear. Some folks say, don't get all excited about this no-fly zone, which are coupled with these very real horrible images out of Ukraine. These calls for no-fly are nothing to worry about because Biden and the American Secretary of State of Blinken have said again and again, we're not going to do no-fly zone. And like Biden has even, you know, bent down into his microphone and said, that would be World War III. There's 74% support for a no-fly zone in the United States right now because of all these horrible images coming out of Ukraine. We have a very weak president. Biden is not a strong president. He has epically low approval numbers. It's an election year. There's these constant images of horror, and they're real, on cable news. There's a cult that's been built up around Zelensky. It's just absolutely extraordinary. This is a practically messianic character now, and he's calling for a no-fly zone. In any event, public opinion for a no-fly is being created every day on TV and on the line. Think about that. Yeah, we'll close the sky with World War III. False narrative, the U.S. cares deeply about Ukrainians. Again and again, there's this bleeding heart, there's this sense of just this deep caring about Ukrainians, really? Then why is it and its media dismissing all Russian peace offers, thereby prolonging the agony and upping the ante of devastation, making it possible that the crimes there could start to match the ones that our allies have committed in Gaza
and in Yemen, and that we ourselves have committed in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm going to be very brutally candid about something here. U.S. policy isn't about helping Ukraine. It's about U.S. imperial strategic aims. And right now, what's shaping up appears to be a campaign to bleed Russia in a prolonged war that will kill thousands, if not tens of thousands more Ukrainians. There's no particular deep concern about that in elite Washington policymaking circles. I am afraid, I hate to break it to folks, the real concerns are very, very different. Now, let me get back to that claim that Putin's invasion is unprovoked. Don't get me wrong. Putin did not have to invade. His invasion is a crime. It is an epic war crime. However, the notion that it's completely unprovoked really, really has to be resisted. It's really false. It's kind of when I think about how ghetto violence is reported on the 10 o'clock news in Chicago and every other major city. There's no excuse for people pulling out guns and shooting each other in the west side of Chicago or the south side of Chicago. Inner city, urban crime, crime anywhere is crime. Crime is crime. But if you know the conditions on the west side of Chicago, you know the conditions on the south side of Chicago or the east side of Detroit or the north side of Milwaukee or the north side of St. Louis, there's nothing surprising about it because of the conditions. And if you want to end the violence, you need to look at the conditions that give rise to it. It's true in foreign policy, too. There's two key points here. The U.S. ruling class had a debate and made a decision after the fall of the Soviet Union. They decided, this was in the 90s, to reject and abandon promises made to Mikhail Gorbachev and Russia as the terms to follow in the wake of the dismantling of the Soviet Empire. Instead of incorporation into a common Europe, combined with demilitarization and the provision of large-scale economic and social assistance to help Russia transition into a post-Cold War European order, the U.S. ruling class in the 1990s decided to continue treating Russia as a hostile power. America imposed harsh neoliberal economic punishment on Russia, leading to, among other things, a drastic decrease in Russian life expectancy, an epic collapse of Russian living standards. Washington pushed its military alliance right up to Russia's western doorstep in Poland, Lithuania, Latvia. Total military and economic humiliation, worsened by lying at the beginning of the process that we wouldn't do that to you. And that humiliation and that deception created the vengeful, fascistic, authoritarian, white, orthodox, nationalist Vladimir Putin and his power within Russia and his initial considerable popularity in that country. Ukraine is a special case. Ukraine ain't Latvia. Ukraine ain't Lithuania. Ukraine is the second biggest country in Europe. Ukraine is of epic historical, cultural, spiritual, ideological, and material significance to Russia historically and to the Russian Empire. There's an ideological component to that. There's a cultural component to that. There's also a strategic and economic component to it. Ukrainian grain, Ukrainian minerals, Ukrainian seaports, and just the vast expanse of Ukrainian land, which goes right into the underbelly of Russia and, in fact, expands east of Moscow. And yes, there has, in fact, been lots of Western and NATO interference in Ukraine. All that significance that I just outlined about Ukraine is really why there's always been a red line around Ukraine. And there's been a lot of Western and NATO interference in Ukraine. In a 2008 NATO agreement called the Bucharest Agreement, it was stated flat out that NATO seeks ultimately the participation of Ukraine in NATO. In 2014, the United States and the West were politically intervened in Ukraine to overthrow a neutral, somewhat pro-Russian elected government there and replace it with a Western-facing, pro-Western capitalist government. The coup was conducted with fascist paramilitaries, in part, that were later integrated under U.S. pressure into the Ukrainian National Guard. There have been numerous joint military exercises with Ukrainian forces conducted by NATO. There have been NATO ships quite recently in the Black Sea. The European Union has funded to the Ukrainian military to the tune of millions of dollars. And now we appear to be in a situation where NATO, which is really the United States, is trying to bleed Russia to death and to give Russia its second Vietnam, the first one being the war in Afghanistan that helped topple the USSR. And now we have the new Western-imposed Vietnam in Ukraine that is meant to topple Putin. How long would it take the U.S. to bomb and reinvade Mexico if Mexico was aligning itself or threatening to align itself or seeming to align itself with a Russian and or Chinese military and economic alliance that had already aligned with numerous other Latin American countries and Canadian provinces? The West is not innocent by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think there's any one particular moment right prior to the Russian invasion that explains this crisis to the same extent that the discovery of missiles in Cuba provoked the Cuban Missile Crisis. Missiles were brought to Cuba in 62 in the wake of the U.S. actually trying to invade Cuba, the Bay of Pigs invasion. The timing is interesting. It's an interesting kind of thing. Why Putin decided to invade when he did. I do think it was fundamentally provoked over years. I suspect that he made some calculations about Western divisions, made some calculations about energy prices, made some calculations about inflation, made some calculations about the weakness of Biden. He clearly waited until his erstwhile ally, China's Olympics, were over. There's a number of things that came together and overdetermined why he picked the moment that he did. To say that NATO and the United States provoked the Russian invasion is not just a left position. Noam Chomsky says it. I say it. George Kennan, the architect of the original Cold War, said don't expand NATO up to the doorstep of Russia, and certainly don't include Ukraine unless you want big trouble. Quote unquote, don't poke the bear. William Burns, the current CIA director, when he was Russian ambassador between 2000 and 2005, warned about excessive NATO expansion and messing with Ukraine. I found on Twitter a statement from Joe Biden in 1997, talking to some policy forum in D.C., saying, don't mess with Ukraine. That's a too far. That's a red line too far. That would freak out Russia for some very good reasons. I'm going to wrap up really quickly. What we want, real simple, peace, end of the war, peace now, before this thing spills over and goes nuclear. I'm not looking for a winner here. End this war so we can breathe again and live on to make the only war that matters, the people's war against capitalism, imperialism. The masses of the world have no country. Fight the rich, not their wars, or maybe more accurately, fight your dominant social and political order, not your social and political order's wars. The other night on MSNBC, I saw a former high diplomat in the Obama administration say that, quote, now is the time to choose sides. And of course, he meant, you know, with democracy against autocracy. And I thought to myself, yes, comrade, now is the time to side with peace and justice and ecology-loving people of the world against the profit, war, and ecocide pigs of Washington, of Moscow, of London, of Brussels, Paris, Ankara, Riyadh, Tel Aviv, and Brasilia. And also against any and all people calling, even if they're a comedian-turned-Western messiah cult hero named Zelensky, also against any and all people calling for U.S. and NATO no-fly zones and jet lanes over Ukraine.
Again, the views expressed in today's episode are the views of Paul Street and are not an official platform of Refuse Fascism. For Refuse Fascism's mission and key statements, please see refusefascism.org. Read more from Paul at Counterpunch and visit his website. Links in the show notes. For more on Ukraine, see last week's episode featuring Andy Z and Paul Street and our episode with Mark Elliotstein. We got some feedback that I wanted to respond to, which basically amounted to saying that our consistent exposure and analysis of American fascism was demoralizing without enough of or the right kind of calls to action. First off, in recent episodes, we have been featuring and promoting Rise Up for the number abortionrights.org, which we believe is a key battleground in the society-wide fight against a fascist future, and it featured voices from the protests against the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida and against the Canadian trucker convoys. But on a deeper level, we, producers of the show, don't believe there are special incantations that we can mutter that will manifest resistance. This podcast was born out of very acute struggle with a singular unifying demand to drive out a sitting regime consolidating fascism. The situation has not been resolved, but has changed. We think that our exposure of the fascist threat we face, our analysis of what that threat is based in, where it came from, and the trajectory it is on, and the system it is, can provide vital elements to the kind of resistance and rising up that is needed now and in the coming period. We will continue to point people to ways to act, including and especially at this moment, joining with Rise Up for the number abortionrights.org. But we want to hear your thoughts. How are you refusing fascism? What does it mean to you? And how does this show support the work that needs to be done? Let us know. As Rise Up for Abortion Rights says in their statement, our only way forward and our best way forward is to resist, to step outside the confines of quote unquote official politics and fill the streets with our fury, rising up with courage and conviction to defeat this assault while bringing closer a future where women and all people are free. We're calling on everyone to wear green for abortion April 8th and get into the streets nationwide to keep abortion legal. New York City, 2 p.m., Union Square on April 9th. Protests are taking place in Austin, Boston, Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Berkeley, Seattle. Find a protest near you or organize one. Learn more and get involved. Visit RiseUp for the number abortionrights.org and follow on Twitter at RiseUp for the number abortion. Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you, share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman, or you can drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org, or leave a voicemail by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course, follow, subscribe, so you never miss an episode. Chip in to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. You can donate by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting the donate button there. Venmo, Refuse Fascism, Cash App, Refuse Fascism. Thanks to Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tinkelman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to the Chicago chapter of Refuse Fascism for organizing the webinar featured in today's episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode, so be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.